I'm hoping that right now there are General Assembly members listening to this saying that Cooper guy could not be more wrong, and we're going to show him why he's wrong. But I don't see a lot of compromise.
On this episode of the WUNC Politics Podcast, setting the table for 2021, I'm Jeff Tabiri. That table, still quite partisan, of course, and the majority of place settings still held by Republicans, at least here in North Carolina. A poo-poo platter of pod topics for you, budget battles, any hope of compromise, the nationalization of state and local politics, new faces of power at the General Assembly, oh, by the way, that anticipated 14th U.S. House seat, and bears. Yes, bears. Chris Cooper is in the queue. He teaches political science and public affairs at Western Carolina, and he joined me via Zoom from his home office earlier this week. To get us started, I asked Cooper for three themes in American politics that he's keeping an ear or eye on in 2021.
So nationally, I think that what I've been calling the COVID triangle is going to continue, right? So thinking about COVID as a policy issue in and of itself, thinking about the way that healthcare relates to that, and of course, the way the economy relates to that. And I think about it in terms of triangle, because I think each one of these pieces is interconnected, right? Each one kind of pushes and pulls on the other. So from a policymaking perspective, I think the vast majority of our conversations will be somewhere inside that triangle.
Okay. Same question, but for North Carolina.
Kind of the same answer, but I would add, I guess, maybe a couple of things to it. So, of course, the COVID triangle, again, I think is going to be critical in North Carolina. We've seen how much many of these policies have devolved down to the states. But also, of course, I mean, redistricting is going to be driving the agenda in North Carolina, a lot of the conversation anyway, for the next decade. And the budget, you know, the fact that we had budget stalemates, the fact that neither side seems to be able to come to a compromise, clearly that will be, borne out in real time this year.
Well, we'll talk budget in a little bit. We'll talk redistricting in a little bit. In recent years, we've seen a nationalization of politics, something you and I have talked about, you've talked about with plenty of people. So much of the policy debates, the campaign advertisements, and those are just two examples, are tied to what's going on in Washington, even if the people and the issues are not really at play in the state capitals or in Main Street America, if you will. Tell me about the shift and whether or not you think it's been better for Democrats or Republicans here.
It's a great question. I think it's been problematic for both in different ways, actually. I'll answer the last part first, which is always a bad idea. But kind of what's happened is, I think, as you described very well, this nationalization of state and local politics, right? We're seeing people run for county commission, mentioning President Trump, sometimes positively, sometimes negatively, rarely neutrally, right? Everybody has an opinion. We see folks running for the General Assembly using the same kinds of rhetoric. Clearly, the Trump brand is still alive and well in North Carolina, as evidenced by Lara Trump, perhaps running for our United States Senate seat. In general, I think it's a bad thing. I think it increases the divisions between the parties at the state and local levels. I think it's not positive. I don't see it stopping anytime soon. I think right now it's kind of tough for the Republican Party. Obviously, their candidate lost for the presidency, and they're kind of creating all of these, which has created all of these conversations. But I think it's not good. I think it leads to affective polarization, meaning just kind of how you feel about somebody. It puts less emphasis on the policy area and more on the person delivering that message. So I think this is it's a negative thing, and I think something we need to learn to fight regardless of partisan affiliation.
You've written recently that we are in a purple state with divided government, and compromise is something that looks somewhat bleak. You still feel that way, right?
I do still feel that way. It's one I want to be proven wrong. So I'm hoping that right now there are General Assembly members listening to this saying that Cooper guy could not be more wrong, and we're going to show him why he's wrong. But I don't see a lot of compromise. Look, we're looking at a state that looks an awful lot like it did before we had this election. And I don't think any of us would point to the last session of the General Assembly and say, well, there's a whole lot of compromise going on there. So I don't really see it changing in the short run.
And just to be clear, that Cooper guy being wrong would be Chris Cooper, no relation to Roy Cooper. I know that there are legislators who listen and already think that Roy Cooper's wrong.
Yes.
But yeah.
That's right. They certainly think Roy Cooper's wrong. Heck, they may think Chris Cooper's wrong. But yes, no relation and indifferent Cooper. I am referring to myself in the third person as if I'm Bob Dole.
So let's talk about the seats of power, the most notable of which have not changed here in North Carolina. Phil Berger entering his 11th year running the Senate, Tim Moore in year 7 presiding over the House, Roy Cooper now in his 5th year as governor. However, some of the second-tier political players are gone. Senate Majority Leader Harry Brown out of Onslow County retired. House Rules Chair David Lewis resigned before pleading guilty to a felony last summer. So who has an elevated status that we ought to perhaps be paying some attention to here in 2021?
That's a great question, and I think one we're all trying to figure out, right? So if we think about the freshmen, right, the people who are kind of younger that I think have maybe an outsized role. So obviously Ricky Hurtado is somebody who continues to be talked about. There was just an article, I can't remember where, the last couple of days that talked about Nancy Pelosi even funneling some money into to Hurtado's campaign. So clearly that is somebody who the Democrats are looking at as a rising star. I know from listening to the to your podcast that there's been even some folks, some conversation that Natalie Murdoch could perhaps be somebody who could run for higher office one day, somebody who is sort of a freshman, right? So she was filled a term, and this is her, will be her first full term in the Senate. I think, interestingly, Sidney Batch and Aaron Paré, both from the same area, both who ran against each other, are people who might have a bit of an outsized role given their very, very junior status. So those are kind of some names that I would look at.
For folks who don't know, Ricky Hurtado is a freshman Democrat in the North Carolina House. He's from Alamance County. He won a redrawn seat last year. He defeated Stephen Ross, a longtime House incumbent. And Hurtado is, I believe, the only Latino in the North Carolina legislature here in this session. Tell me about Kathy Harrington, Republican of Gaston County. She is now the majority leader in the Senate. And she, I think, is just about the most powerful woman in North Carolina politics at that point. Am I giving her too much credit?
No, I don't think you are at all. One of the many problems of North Carolina and many other states is that our female representation in our General Assembly has been, for lack of a better term, poor. So we've run somewhere between a fifth and a fourth of members of our General Assembly who are female, obviously as opposed to the much higher number that's male, despite what we see in the population and in the voting age population. So I think you're right. I think she is perhaps the most powerful woman in North Carolina politics. Will that change soon? Perhaps. We did see a fairly good year for female representation across the country and in North Carolina. But yes, that is absolutely a name to watch.
One other name that I get a lot of questions about, I've spent a little bit of time thinking about, is Lieutenant Governor Mark Robinson, this political novice who really jumped onto the scene with it was a viral YouTube video at a Greensboro City Council meeting. And he's now in a position where a lot of people are going, well, is he going to run for governor in 4 years? Is he going to jump into this Senate race? Like, who's this guy and what's next? Because the lieutenant governor seat is not a particularly powerful place. I throw my palms up a little bit with Robinson, but what do you make of him?
Yeah, I mean, fascinating. It'd be a place we could start, right? Here's somebody who does not have a long political resume, quite the opposite. Somebody who came to office, as you said, really kind of was with a bang with this YouTube video. So if we think about people who, you know, toiled in the background for a while and were kind of really active in their party, and everybody kind of saw as an up-and-coming star and was sort of slowly recruited up. This is the opposite story, right? Here's somebody who none of us statewide, I think, had heard of until this YouTube clip. He obviously is very, very good at drawing attention to himself, sometimes in ways that maybe aren't so positive. The lieutenant governor seat, as you noted, doesn't have a lot of power, and that is probably an understatement. It has virtually no power, sits on some boards, can break some ties, can't really do much, but they can draw attention to themselves. It has not traditionally been a great path to the governor's mansion, as we certainly saw with Dan Forrest this last time, but we'll see if Robinson perhaps could have this kind of odd combination of factors that could promote him a little bit higher.
So those are some of the 1A or 2-tier players, but I mentioned Berger and Moore and Cooper, and if we think about those as three of the leading, if not the three most prominent seats at the North Carolina political table, they've been there for 5 years. They haven't, for my money, particularly gotten along. We haven't had a new budget in a year and a half now. Do you see the dynamic between the three of them changing? And if so, like, what's the reasoning behind it?
I don't see it changing. Look, these folks know each other. They know, you think about it like sports in some ways. Like, they know when somebody goes left, they know when somebody goes right, they know when they're going to shoot, they know when they need to box them out. They know each other, and they know how they play the game. I was interested to see if Roy Cooper would kind of come out a little bit more bloodied after the last budget battle, and he didn't. He obviously came out looking very good, and it didn't appear that the lack of a formal state budget really hurt him electorally. Perhaps because of COVID, we didn't even really hear that conversation that much on the campaign trail. So I don't think anybody has much of an incentive to change right now. Again, this is another one where I hope I am wrong.
So let me flip that a little bit and say, well, what's the incentive? Let's flash forward 5 months here. We're at the end of June, and the legislature has worked hard on a budget. You know, they have actually worked hard on it, and then they're also going to tell you just how hard they worked on it. And they send a budget over to the executive mansion. What's the incentive for that at that point in a non-election year for Cooper to veto another budget? Isn't there some, and maybe I'm not being the eternal optimist here, but isn't there some rationale on the argument of, like, all right, y'all just need to get a budget done this year, that the stakes are lessened?
Sure. Yes. I mean, I think we know that if somebody can't run for re-election, then you know, their policy issue, their decisions change a little, even if what they really believe doesn't. At the same time, Cooper hasn't really given us much daylight on that, and I think he has gotten wins from his own party in some ways by not compromising. And if he does compromise on a budget, fairly or unfairly, he's going to be viewed as a sellout from his own party. And the effect that might have down ballot could be driving a little bit of decision making there. So I hope I'm wrong. I hope that by untethering him from the reelection, from reelection coming up, that will change his behavior. I'm just not sure that it will in this case.
So again, as we think about this bridge from state to national politics, I can't help but note the presidency has become, to an extent, more of a power position in recent years as we think about executive orders. And we think about gridlock in the Congress, and President Obama and President Trump have really utilized executive orders, some to success, some to court challenges, and not to success. But I wonder if you think whether or not Roy Cooper is going to take something of a different path here. He can't run for re-election in 2024. Do you have any reason to think he's going to pursue more executive orders or executive authority if he continues to effectively just butt heads with lawmakers?
You know, I think he may try. Obviously, you know, certainly we've talked about before, governor does not have a lot of formal powers in North Carolina by design, right? You look at any of our three constitutions that we've had in this state, and all three are pretty clear. Governor doesn't have much power. This is a legislature-driven state. So, yes, I think he will try to exert all the power that he has. I think that's one reason that COVID-19 ended up playing fairly well politically, is that is an area where he did have some power. And he was able to draw media attention most days through press conferences, and kind of the implementation of COVID-19 ended up being at the state level and kind of within the governor's mansion. So yes, I think he will absolutely try. How successful he is, we'll see.
Redistricting is likely to happen late summer or early fall. North Carolina is almost assuredly getting a 14th U.S. House seat, and there'll be some attention on whether or not that 14th seat is firmly red, if it's going to be another competitive district. I can't imagine they're going to cede another seat to Democrats. That would be a little bit surprising. Senator Phil Berger has signaled that they plan, at least as of now, in late January, to implement and utilize a lot of the same processes that they used during the court-ordered redraw of 2019. What I mean, is it just rinse and repeat? Like, Republicans are still in charge. They again get to draw the maps. We again know that there will be a court challenge of some sort afterward, because that's how it's been for three or four decades here in North Carolina. But what else as it pertains to redistricting?
The one thing I would draw folks' attention to is there's going to be a ton of attention on where the 14th district is. And I would encourage people, yes, pay attention to that, but also pay attention to how it shifts the districts around it, right? This is not just going to be, we slap a 14th district in the middle of North Carolina and nothing is affected. This is dropping a big old rock right in the middle of a very small pond. The ripple effects are going to matter. And so those details of which counties are in and which counties are out and some of the more far-flung districts may mean as much as the address of the 14th congressional district.
We hear rumors from time to time about, oh, there's a seat that's going to be drawn for this person or that person, or this person would like to have a seat drawn favorably to him or to her so that they have a shot at running for Congress, a favorable shot. And I'm wondering what you think about that as it relates to kind of the package of variables that go into drawing districts. It's not as though we can say, oh, Chris Cooper out there in Cullowhee, which is in Jackson County, we want to draw a congressional seat for him. Boom. It's not necessarily as simple as that, is it?
It's not as simple as that at all. And I think we need to remember that there's no rule that says that members of Congress need to live in their district. So it's a very different calculus when you're talking about congressional redistricting versus General Assembly redistricting. So it's a little strange. General Assembly folks do need to live in their home districts. Members of Congress do not. As a matter of fact, to play out your Western example, we had somebody running in the 11th congressional district this last round, the seat that eventually ended up with Madison Cawthorn, who I think could see the ocean from their house. You just need to live in the state of North Carolina, not in that district. And so the way incumbency advantage works and drawing lines for incumbents works means a little bit different for Congress than it does for the General Assembly. And we can see that as we see some people already starting to declare they're going to run for 2022 when they don't even know what the district's going to look like.
It'll be very interesting. I will not ask you which U.S. House member is most vulnerable in 2022, because again, we don't know the districts upon which they are running. I think it is worth noting that that first re-election bid is often when a candidate is most vulnerable. So Kathy Manning, Deborah Ross, Madison Cawthorn, there are people who are inherently going to have a little bit of a heavier lift to get back to Congress, and we wait to see what the lines are there.
One thing I'm watching is Madison Cawthorn in the 11th, and there are already rumors about him perhaps getting primaried, obviously by a Republican, and he hasn't weighed in on the record, but a lot of that speculation, at least, has centered around Chuck Edwards, a Republican General Assembly member from Henderson County, the same county as Madison Cawthorn. So that's, you know, one to keep an eye on, not just how Cawthorn is perceived by Democrats poorly, but also how he's perceived by Republicans.
As we think about this next election cycle, and I realize there's election fatigue and people don't necessarily want to think about it, but we're, in effect, we're already in it with this U.S. Senate run. I think Georgia might have been the surprise in 2020, as again, we think about this national North Carolina hybrid or bridge. Deservedly so, Stacey Abrams got a lot of credit for what happened in mobilizing voters in Georgia. It feels, to some extent, only natural to think about that In relation to North Carolina, North Carolina does have a more rural population, a less black population. But I'm wondering if you've kind of played that scenario out in your head at all, and if you think that there are ways in which progressive efforts in North Carolina could take something of a playbook, something of a note out of the playbook from Georgia.
Yeah, I think so. So a few notes on that. I'm glad you brought it up. First of all, Georgia, you know, there's a lot made, right, of North Carolina and Georgia being, you know, North Carolina stayed red, Georgia flipped blue. I guess I would have some, yes, that is absolutely true. I think we just need to remember each state is on just barely one side of that razor's edge. So North Carolina and Georgia are actually more similar. In other words, their electoral outcomes for the presidency were more similar in 2020 than North Carolina and the next most Republican state. So we are once again, if you don't want to call us purple, you can call us the bluest red state in the country. As far as the Stacey Abrams piece, I agree. And I think mobilization matter, particularly it looks like in the runoff election. So that's where the African-American turnout really spiked in Georgia was in the runoff. And yes, I do think there's a playbook the Democrats can take from that. If you go back and look at 2008, which is the last time that the Democrats won the presidency in North Carolina, it's the only year in recent memory where Democratic turnout was about the same as Republican turnout. So shouldn't be a shock to anybody. You turn out more of your voters, you're more likely to win the election. So yes, it needs to be a mobilization game for the Democrats.
You and I are recording this conversation. I'm in my closet covered by a sheet around, surrounded by folded meshware items and socks and things. You're in Cullowhee in a more professionally decorated office. How much snow have y'all had?
Three days where our kids have not gone to school. So, which is how I judge.
Have you seen a bear in the winter in Western North Carolina?
Not in the winter. Summer, yes. Winter, no.
You had a bear encounter a few years ago, involving you and a mountain bike, and the mountain bike might have saved you.
Yes.
Tell me more.
So I was at, if anybody knows, Bent Creek, which is over near Asheville. Great spot to go mountain biking or trail running. And I came screaming down a hill and looked ahead of me. I thought I was a dog, and then I realized that dogs can't climb trees. And I realized that I had inadvertently treed a bear. So I stopped, and then I saw the mama bear on the other side of the trail. And fairly long story made fairly short and cleaned up for radio. The mama bear took a couple of steps towards me. I put the bike in between me and the mama bear as if that would help. Eventually, the baby bear scampered out of the tree, and then two other baby cubs came across the trail, and I realized I had not only split a mom and a cub, but I split a mom and three cubs. So I waited about 5 minutes, looked like the bear wasn't paying a lot of attention, thought I'd go downhill. Bear turned around and let out the loudest sort of chortle, bark, scream that I've ever heard in my life, and I hightailed it back up the mountain for my fastest climb in history.
Did you scream or cry?
None of those things, but my stomach was not in a good place. We'll just leave it there.
Have you ever seen a bear in the wild? I saw a black bear one morning last summer in Blowing Rock. I was with my son. It was exhilarating and indeed terrifying. Fortunately, I was inside my car. The North Carolina political news does not slow. We've got another contestant in that 2022 U.S. Senate race, the seat that Richard Burr is retiring from next year. Democratic State Senator Jeff Jackson of Mecklenburg County made his long-rumored run official this week. And state lawmakers are back in Raleigh as of Wednesday. A couple of COVID relief bills are likely moving in the weeks ahead. For more reporting on that, continue to head over to our website, WUNC.org. Until our next pod, the requisite Friday review, hope the week treats you well. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Thanks for listening.